B. Clark. The date is August 18th, 1987, and we are in Victoria. All right, maybe we could begin with where and when you were born.
I was born in Victoria on April 4th, 1915.
Is there a history of military service in your family?
No.
None at all?
No.
And when did you first become interested in the military?
In 1930, when I joined the Canadian Scottish Brass Band.
Why did you join? Was it just to play music? Or?
Just to play music.
Yeah. Mm. No real interest in military service? Or?
Not at that time, no.
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 When did you... Well, what was it like playing in the band for the Canadian Scottish?
Well, we used to play on all the church parades and 24th of May parade and so forth, all the way. Just, and then Beacon Hill Park on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah. Yep.
And it wasn't until 1939 that you joined as a private?
As a private in the regular force then, because the Scottish had gone active service.
And you were wanted to get involved with the war eventually?
When, that's right.
Yeah. And what was it life like as a private in Canadian Scottish?
Pretty rough.
Pretty rough. You were in the armory?
In the Bay Street Armory, yeah. Then we moved to Otter Point.
And what were the accommodations like?
Well, the army, if the Otter Point was, the armories was nothing but flat cots in one of the halls there. And we lived there like that for a period of about 3 or 4 months. And then the unit moved to Otter Point, which was the relief camp. So there were just old wooden huts out there. And that camp is still, it's now on Otter Court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was the food like?
Regular army rations.
Do you remember what your pay was as a private?
It was somewhere about 60 or 59 cents a day.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of training did you receive?
Basic training.
Basic training.
Yeah, which is standard army procedure. Test of elementary training like weapons and field practice and so forth. Yeah.
What was the discipline like?
In the Scottish?
Yeah.
Very rough. We had a chap who was a sergeant major with the Princess Pat Permanent Force by the name of Charlie Faulkner. And he got his commission in the Canadian Scottish. And he really whipped us into shape in a very short time. So we really had a taste of permanent force in a hurry.
Were you anxious to get overseas?
Yes. Well, we moved from Victoria to Divert, Nova Scotia. At that time, I was transport sergeant. So I went ahead of the unit to Oshawa, Ontario, on the assembly line of the military vehicles as they came off the Oshawa line. And then I joined the unit at Divert.
And how long were you there before you went overseas?
Oh, about almost a year, I guess. Yeah.
And what sort of training did you receive there?
Well, from Victoria, the land of sunshine, to 40 below in Divert.
Yeah.
We arrived in Divert into an unfinished army camp. No windows, pot belly stove, and the temperature was hovering in the 20s and so forth. It was pretty rough.
Were you living in, were the H huts being built?
H huts being built, yeah. No windows at that time.
Oh.
No, they're all under construction, and I understand now it's an Air Force camp. Yeah. It was so just outside of Truro.
Life there was rough, was it?
For a Western boy, yes. Very.
How well was the unit equipped by this time compared to how it had been in the mid-30s or even as late as 38?
Well, we were fully equipped at Divert.
Yeah.
Vehicle-wise, weapon-wise, and everything. And we did, the funny part of it was, they were going to make us a ski battalion. And in the snow in Divert, we used to do training in the snow. And coming from the west, where very few of us had been on skis, we had quite a number of minor casualties.
Were these cross-country skis?
Yeah, cross-country skiing and hitting fences, going down hills. I know I hit a couple of fences.
How long did that training last?
That lasted almost a year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And by this time you must have been very anxious to leave Nova Scotia.
Well, the first division had gone.
Yeah.
And we were getting itchy feet. And so we finally got over to Aldershot in England.
How was your crossing?
Very rough and scary. We went on a three-ship convoy. I was on the Strathiden, a British luxury liner. And in the convoy was the Empress of Russia. They used to ply the waters here. And we were midway across the Atlantic, and they were contemplating kicking the Russia out of the convoy because they couldn't cut down their smoke. It had a smoke problem with the, and it was a dead giveaway going across. But we all got there safely.
Lots of seasickness, was there?
Yes, to say the least.
How many men were on board?
Well, a full battalion was on board then.
Yeah.
Numbering in the old 900 or something like that.
So was it crowded conditions? Would you have been down in the...
We were down partly in the hold.
Yeah. On hammocks?
Yeah, no, 2x4 bunks.
2x4
bunks. Mm-hmm.
What was your first impression of England?
Well, we went straight from the landing point to Salamanca Barracks in Aldershot, which was the permanent camp of the British.
Yeah.
So we were really introduced to army life when we were in Aldershot.
Tell me about conditions at Aldershot.
Aldershot is somewhat like the Bay Street Armories, only maybe 15 or 16 of them all around. Big rooms, bunks all over the place, lining up for mess, and lining up for everything. It was quite an eye-opener to go there.
I've heard that the food was bad. They had something called Bubbles and Squeak.
Yeah, Bubbles and Squeak and cold macaroni fried for breakfast. Oh, yeah.
How were conditions for a sergeant? You were a sergeant at this time?
Sergeant, yeah.
How were they compared to the officer and then to the private?
Well, the sergeant was above the private,
yeah.
So it was a little better. We had our own mess. And there was no lineups for us for mess calls or anything like that. But the private had a pretty rough time. Yeah, pretty rough time.
How about living quarters for the sergeant?
Well, we were all together in one barracks.
Yeah.
I would say very much better than the private. I would not want to have been a private.
No.
In those days.
How much was a sergeant being paid?
$1 something a day.
Okay, let's talk about training while at Aldershot. What sort of, was there any new training for you? Or new equipment?
We were introduced to different guns, like the Sten gun and so forth, the automatic weapons. And then that's when we first started the live field ammunition. And that was training in earnest, you might say, when we got out on that sort of thing. But no, it was quite an eye-opener. Quite an experience. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
How long did you stay there before you went back to Victoria?
Well, I wasn't there. I didn't leave there. Aldershot to come back here. We went from there to various places like Horsham, Seaford, all over the West Coast, and we were out on exercises.
Some of the big exercises?
Oh, yeah. Exercise Pirate and Standby. And
what were those like?
Well, there's... Actually, when we got into Exercise Pirate, it was almost the same as D-Day. We got into little boats and went out. We never knew whether we were coming back or not. And then when we were up in Inverary in Scotland, we went out on field exercises in the moors, where they gave you so much of a ration, cold ration and a compass, and say, there you are, now find your way back.
Did you take an objective or?
Yeah. It was just a fake war.
Yeah.
Off to.
How well do you think it prepared you for D-Day?
I think it was the best experience that prepared me wonderfully.
Yeah.
No, it was. I don't think we could have managed without it, such exercises as Pirate and so forth. It was rough going. And we were at Seaford, down in the south coast of England. When Dieppe was on. And we were actually stationed in Storrington. And that was like Oak Bay is to the Causeway. About the same distance. That's where the 2nd Division left from. So we watched the casualties come back, and that sort of shook us quite a bit.
And when did you go back to Gordon Head?
And then I went from there to Horsham in England, our unit moved there. And we were at that stage of the game, we were getting a lot of Octu people. People who coming direct out of university, getting their commission and coming in. And they found it pretty rough, because their basic training here in Canada was a little different to what it was over there. So the 3rd Division selected about 14 of us to go for officers' training. And we went and wrote exams, which were all academic. Like I hadn't touched algebra and geometry and trig and all that for years. And needless to say, I think about 6 of them failed the test. So they decided they would put us all back to school. So we went back to basic training in school, then rewrote the exam. And those that made it, we all sent back here to Victoria and Gordon Head.
Were you happy about that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, you see, I was married when I came back. And I got married here during my time back in Victoria. So, the first time when we came from DeBert, we came back to, when we were in DeBert, we came back to Victoria for 48 hours leave, which was 14 days by train. 5 this way, 5 that way for 48 hours in Victoria. So it was during one of those that I'd been going out with my wife then for 10 years. We were married. And I was quite happy to come back to Victoria for training. A lot of them went to Sandringham in England, and some of them went to Brockville. But the group that I was with came right here to Victoria.
And what was the training like there, officers' training?
Well, you must remember that Gordon Head at that stage of the game, they had taken a lot of people out of universities and put them in as officer training with very little military training. So it was quite good. We were well accepted coming back. Of course, we knew a lot more about the field conditions than they did up here. And we got on very well with the group up here.
And how long was the course?
Well, it was, let's see, 3 months for your first stripe, first pip, and then an additional 3 months to get your second pip, or go to Calgary. So we, having had commando training, 4 of us elected to stay here, on condition that as soon as we became lieutenants, we would be on the first draft to catch our unit. And Brigadier McLean, I think it was the OC, he agreed. And true to his word, the day we graduated, we were on the draft the next day.
Who were your instructors at Gordon Head? Were they First World War vets?
Yeah, most of them were. And some of them were, I have a big photo I'll show you and point out some of these fellows. We had Ernie Lacaine, who was a First World War vet, and he was out at, he had owned a grocery store at Langford. And then Jimmy O'Toole, he was in real estate. He was First World War vet. And they're all there. No, they were very good, but it was, as I say, it was 2 different wars.
Yeah.
One was 1914-18 was to take a trench. Mm-hmm. The war itself was to take a trench and hold it. In the Second World War, the only time you was in a trench was when the bombers came over.
And how were they training you at Gordon Head? Was it in the World War I fashion, or?
The majority of it was, until 4 of us got back here with the commando training, then we switched to commando training and hand-to-hand combat and house cleaning, clearing and so forth like that, storming old houses in Victoria and running up staircases and down again. So it was a little different type of war than going from point A to take a trench in point B. You fought every inch of your way to get to it in the Second World War. And I know some of the chaps, the late Captain Jack Bryan, the Victoria chap, we were pushing into Puto and Bazan on a counterattack, which is a railway crossing. And we were going through a wheat field, which was, the wheat was then about 3 feet high. And they just mowed us down. And poor old Jack got hit, and he fell, and he got run over by one of our own tanks, because you couldn't see him in the wheat. And I lost my batman at Puto. He was a little chap from the interior, Rosslyn. He was only 17 years old when his mom had died. So it was a little different than just... Now I say it was a wonderful experience. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
That
scared?
Time?
Scared? Yeah. Yes. To use a vulgar expression, I've often said if blood was brown, I was shot many times. No, I was... Every one of us were scared. But, no, it was a great experience.
Okay, after the training, the 6 months, you went back overseas as a lieutenant?
Yeah, as a lieutenant.
Happy to get back?
Yes, happy to get back. And I went to... I was appointed second in command of the carrier platoon, which, you know what a carrier is, that armored mechanized vehicle with the machine guns, until I found out the 2IC, the second in command of the carrier, was not going in France until about 10 days after the invasion. And having been a Scottish since 1930 and come up through, I literally begged the company commander of A Company to take me in as A Company. So I commanded number 9 platoon in A Company.
And what part of the year was this and you came back?
That would be, I was back in the Rally Wake for Christmas. So it would be in the fall when I came back.
Fall of 43. So what was the training like after you came back? And how was it different as a lieutenant than as a sergeant?
Well, you had to make decisions and make them in a hurry. And all our exercises were with live ammunition, which is a little different than saying boom, bang, you're shot. You kept your head down or else. And no, that was exercise pirate, which is a dandy. And as I say, they used to put tickets in these boats and take it out. You never knew whether you're coming back or whether this was one of the temporary invasions.
Were there many casualties?
Yes, quite a number.
They were firing live rounds at you from the shore to the beaches?
Oh, yeah. It was a little scary because they were using tracers. Now, a tracer is every fifth bullet coming out of a machine gun is a red thing. And you could trace it to where your objective was. When you saw these things coming at you, it scared hell out of you. And as I told Reg before, we landed in Corsair on the beach. And it was originally planned that A Company, which I was in, would take this farmyard. And I was supposed to have the reserve platoon, number 9, 7, 8, and 9. When we got there, Bob Turnbull, who was platoon commander of number 7 platoon, was hit right on the beach. So I was told to take over his position. When we took over his position, the carriers and the tanks that were being unloaded on the beach were being fired on behind this haystack up on the hill. And it turned out to be a concrete emplacement with a German 88 in it. So I reported back to my company commander, who in turn reported to Colonel Cavadu, and I was told to take it out. And that's where I came up with this name, Who Me.
Yeah, read that in the book.
When it says Who Me, I thought it might be cashiered. Yeah. So it was taken out, and we did pretty good on it. But scared, yes. We were all scared. But nobody wanted to show it.
Okay, let's go back to some of the preparation for the invasion. What other exercises besides pirate were you on, or what other training were you given?
Well, the last one, I think, before, the invasion was overlord. But we were on exercise pirate and all sorts of them. It'd be pretty hard for me to think of their names now. I'd have to look them up.
Okay, let's talk about the actual... let's talk about life in England for a minute or two. What was it like in England? What was your first impression of London?
The craziest place I'd ever seen. Yeah. Oh, it was crazy. I couldn't understand the attitude of the British. They're the greatest people when it came down to it. You see, when we were there, we were subjected to the V1s and V2, the buzz bombs. And to see these people sleeping in the subways, little kids down there, it shook us. And they're living, 50 feet below ground on the side of the railway track, all huddled up. But they're the bravest people in the world when it came right down to it.
Did the Canadians and the British get along well?
I would say yes, much more so than the Americans and the British. Because, A, we're closer to the pay levels. But when the American came in with the American, he was paid 3 times as much as a Canadian. So that meant about 6 times as much as a British soldier. So, the camaraderie between the Canadian and the British was far better than the Canadian and the American, or the British and the American.
Okay, let's go to the concentration area before D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you in there, behind the wire?
I would say we were in there in about 2.5 weeks.
Doing virtually nothing?
Well, doing
loading
PT.
And doing Oh, is that right?
Exercise training to keep you fit. And we had such people that come into the camp as Montgomery, King George V. I always remember the day that King George V came into the camp. It was just a tent camp in this common and all behind the barbed wire. And the reason for that is we knew the code words for the area in which we're going to land. Like Berlin was a code name, Caen was a code name, and we knew exactly where we were going to land and what towns we were going to run into. And down to lieutenants, we all had the operational maps with us.
The privates wouldn't have known, would they, or the non-coms?
Some would, like the platoon runners would and things like that, but not the average one. They all knew we were going somewhere. And the thing I couldn't understand, and never will understand, is the from day one, when we got to Britain, we had a thing called a gas mask. You ate with it, you slept with it, you went to the bathroom with it. You couldn't go anywhere without your gas mask. Yet when we got on the boats at Portsmouth, they were stacked on the wharf, and we did not take them with us.
And they weren't really needed.
No. Never could understand that. When it was your right arm, every day prior to that, if you went to the bathroom and they caught you without a gas mask with you, watch out. And then suddenly, stacked in neat piles. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about D-Day. What would I have seen if I'd been in your shoes right from the time you woke up to the you landed and beyond?
What you've seen, a hell of a bustle at the camp. And you had to get ready in a hurry in full marching order. And then down to the wharfs we went. And everyone was on a move. There's an air of excitement. We knew we were going somewhere, but we didn't actually know the exact time. We knew we were going because General Eisenhower was in the camp. And walking through the camp, he was drinking coffee out of tin cups out of the men's mess. And he wished them all good luck. So we knew we were going, but just where we didn't know, or when, until that morning.
What was the feeling of the men?
Raring to go. Just raring to go. You couldn't hold them back. But the expression of these fellas' faces, when these little boats going in, you know, across the English Channel. You see, where these were all in the davits of the Queen Emma, which was a P&O boat. So at a certain hour on the morning of D-Day, we all clamp into the davits, up on the davits, and they put us in the boat.
All right, we're talking about the D-Day invasion, and we have the official Navy photographs in front of us. I was wondering, what are these bicycles for that are all over the ship?
Well, the idea of that was Sea Company in our battalion. Their thing was to get as far inland as they could. So everyone is in a folding bicycle. So they folded it up, put it under their arm, and ran down the gangplank, got on and pedaled their butt as far inland as they could go. And then we consolidated inland. That was the idea, is to get as many of the assaults in and as far into France as they could, to not interfere with the buildup that was coming behind us. Those are balloons, and this is about an inch steel cable that's attached to the craft at this end, and the balloons are up here to prevent aircraft coming in and dive bombing the LCAs and the LCDs.
There was no problem with that, was there?
Well, there was one or two that had to put it down. The vehicles bogged down in the sand and the type of terrain in which you operated. And all this was heavily fortified up in here. They were just shooting in on the beach. Uh-huh. That's what you call not quite a dry landing.
Yes.
When you came in off the front of the LCA, they dropped the front and in you went. So the idea was to get in there so that you couldn't be strafed along the beach.
It was a choppy crossing. The weather was very bad, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, very. Well, as a matter of fact, a storm came up, and I understand D-Day was supposed to have been June the 5th, but this storm came up, and they put it off one day. Now, here's a shot. These are what you call hedgehogs.
Mm-hmm.
They're all planted in there in hopes that these LCAs would land on them, and up they'd go. But they didn't. But you see here, they took cables in and tied it to anything there so these fellows could get off down the ramps and pull themselves ashore.
And where did you land?
Biras Amir. Right along the coast. Now this is another shot of one of the other vessels going in. You can see there was quite a flotilla out here, but it's quite varied pictures. And some went in, like these went in and then patrolled parallel to the shore so that the smaller craft could come in. Now here is a picture of Portsmouth.
Uh-huh.
You say, what was it like? This is loading the craft, there's the trains, here's troops just coming in, getting aboard these things, ready to go. And there's all the K rations, which is basically chocolate and crackers. Now there's the early dawn on the coast of France.
How much opposition did you meet?
Considerable. Yeah, they were pretty well fortified, the whole thing here. Fortunately, I understand that the German High Command didn't think you were coming in here. They were more or less up here with the heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
this picture shows what the weather was like.
Yeah.
Very choppy.
And there's a direct hit of something. Now this is what you call the Mulberry Dock. Now the idea was that they would take these ships in, old ships, in and sink them. So they have a dock from point A out to here in case they couldn't come in here with these things. They would have docked out here and driven along the dock. Now these are some of the tanks that are just in. You can see they were all waterproof so they could go in about 3 feet of water.
And what time would this be at?
That would be approximately 7:30 in the morning. Yeah. Now, all these signals on here meant something to the Navy, but not to the Army. Mm-hmm. That shows their position in the flotilla.
What time did you yourself land?
I would say it was about 4 to 5 in the morning. Here's some of them that didn't quite make it.
Yeah.
So from when they grounded there, the only way was to walk on the bottom to get in. You know, all these officials, they're not faked in any way. This gives you an idea of the number of balloons that were in the air.
Yeah. The number of ships?
Yeah. So they're all attached about this size, not the small craft. Now there's the Oerlikon guns.
The anti-aircraft?
Yeah, Oerlikons. That's the pom-pom gun there. That was wired out quite well. But you see, they're all lined up ready to go in. And all of them had their time that they hit the beach. Yes, it was quite choppy that morning. And along with this flotilla way out here, we had two ships that plied out of Victoria on the CNR, Prince Henry and the Prince David. And I had two pictures of them, but now there's the expression on the fellow's face that are in the small craft waiting to go in.
It was very crowded.
It was very crowded.
Do you know what group this would be?
This was the Canadian Scottish, but what platoon it was, I wouldn't know. I've had my magnifying glass and you can read it right here. 3rd Canadian Division. It's a light blue. I guess this is the last letter from home, we might say. Now these